producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy Award-winning band, Gets Up. Like us on facebook.com/RUWithSonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on twitter.com/RUWithSonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.
Listening to KBOO Portland. Up next, the struggle with Olivia and Alyssa.
...31st and receive free gifts and prizes from the Give Guide. Just click the donate banner on the KBOO app to keep community radio strong and vibrant in Portland and beyond.
Hello, I'm Eugene Rashad. Join me every Saturday from 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. for the best in jazz on your community radio station, KBOO 90.7 on your FM dot.
But I dig, and I know you dig, because I got 4 requests for this thing already today. Strutting right with it.
That was KBOO volunteer disc jockey George Page. Page has been playing jazz and popular black music on KBOO for the past 12 years.
What I do to the audience I draw, hopefully, is to please them with all types of black music. Mostly what you can't hear as a rule on larger black-oriented stations in L.A. or San Francisco. I play a lot of blues and a lot of jazz. All of it's black-oriented, but it's not the cuts you're going to hear on the other jazz shows. It's not the cuts you're going to hear on other stations, because other stations just don't play jazz and blues in a black vein the way I do here.
This is Alyssa Pariah. This week I want to play audio from a talk given at the Riverside Church in New York City, What Could a Sanders Presidency Mean for Racial Justice, with 3 brilliant black women. And I'll speak to you all again in the new year, live in studio with Olivia Pace, my co-host.
And the fact that we are even having these conversations on the debate stage, the fact that we they're now asked, you know, what do you think the biggest foreign policy threat to America is, and over 50% of the candidates are now saying climate change, when Bernie Sanders said that 3 years ago and was heckled and laughed at by the punditry, you know, for an entire, like, news cycle, you know, that is because of putting into action and supporting these kind of movements, even when you're off the campaign cycle. And that, to me, is one of the biggest selling points as well, is that, you know, people want to know that you're going to be there for them when it doesn't do anything for you. And movements don't die when you're elected if they're really a movement, right? And they don't, and we didn't have this movement die just because Bernie Sanders lost in 2016, and that gives me a lot of hope.
So some people defend means-tested programs. Those are ones that we historically associate with targeting specific minority groups and providing either support or increased funding for those communities. Some people defend them because they target those who are most in need and thus dispense money more efficiently, so the claim says. Socialists typically push for universal programs, programs that are accessible by all. Can you speak to the strategy of the Sanders campaign in focusing on universal programs? And can you elaborate on how those programs can change the conditions of class struggle rather than just the material conditions for those people who use those programs?
Yeah, I really like this point, and I think this is such an important political question, right? So sometimes Senator Sanders gets characterized as kind of like a dreamer and that things are pie in the sky and this how are you going to do X, Y, and Z question gets asked. And the irony is that gets asked more often about his universal policies than anything else. Even though the fact of pursuing a universal policy is in and of itself an incredible political strategic move. And this is the reason why. I mean, I know a lot of people in this room are experts. The DSA crowd knows a lot about what this stuff means already. But for people who are watching, you know, so a means tested program is a program that administers goods based on the economic status of the person looking for it, right? So you only qualify for X, Y, and Z. You only qualify for SNAP. You only qualify for certain kind of assistance if you are below a certain income threshold. Universal program like Social Security says no matter what, when you hit a certain age, you're going to get this benefit. The benefit of having universal program is that everybody in society gets it. So everybody in society is bought in. And what happens because of political inertia is once you establish a program like that, everyone is very reluctant to have it taken away, right? Everybody's grandmother is on Social Security. Everybody relies on it in some way, shape, or form. And so when it comes under threat, you're able to mobilize a huge mass of people to push back against it. Meanwhile, means-tested programs is very easy to say, as we're very familiar with what happened in the 1980s and 90s, and currently, is that there's a lot of hand-wringing and moralizing about the undeserving poor who receive those programs. Welfare queens, Cadillacs, et cetera, you've heard it all before. So there are some people who might say, why cancel everybody's student debt? There's some people who are able to make a good amount of money, who are able to keep up with their loan payments, and they don't need it. And aren't you wasting a ton of money canceling those people's debts? Well, I would argue on several points there. One is that the overwhelming majority of student debt is by people who make not very much money at all, right? The average American graduates with $30,000 worth of debt. I would also argue that a lot of the people who do earn larger salaries because they took out a lot of student debt are in those jobs because they have to pay off their student debt. Now, it's a bit of a personal issue for me because that's the spot I was stuck in, right? I was a lawyer. I did not want to be a lawyer. I desperately wanted to stop being a lawyer, but I also had to keep up with a $2,300 monthly payment, right? And what kind of job was I going to take that was going to be able to let me keep up with that, right? And so when we talk about maternal mortality rates and wanting to incentivize doctors, particularly Black and Brown doctors, to go back into communities and serve those communities, you have to unleash them from their financial tethers, right, and enable them to take a lower paying job. But the most important point here and the point of this question is that once everybody is bought in, everybody is invested in it, suddenly you go from having a sliver of the population who's invested in this student debt cancellation to everybody understanding what's going on and that they're going to be impacted as well. Moreover, it's a much easier argument to make. So our student debt cancellation plan can be summed up as such. Do you have student debt? It's canceled. Now, other people's plans, and I won't name names, but there is, you know, another candidate whose plan can be basically summed up as, if you You can get up to $20,000 of your debt canceled if you start a business in a low-income community that lasts for 3 years and your debt comes from Pell Grants. I think I got all the points, but
it's catchier, the second one, actually. You got it.
And for years, Americans have been sold on these kind of technocratic neoliberal policies, and then you ask why people aren't inspired to come out to the polls at the end of a long day. Mm-hmm. Right? So there's a benefit in simplicity and clarity, and there's a benefit in terms of how much buy-in you have from the public when you present things this way.
I also think that this is an opportunity that we have to think differently about some of these things, and to not also be constrained by the kind of inbuilt constraints that exist. So I think that, you know, universal programs are important, but we also have to pay attention to the ways that there is disproportionate harm that exists in this country. So something like Social Security, that everyone pays into and everyone receives, also reflects the inequality that African Americans in particular have experienced through the job market over the course of a lifetime. And so then it becomes an issue of how are we repairing particular aspects of racism and inequality that exist in some communities among some groups of people and not others. And I think that sometimes that has been, even if we talk about the universal health care, that in and of itself doesn't deal with the way that health care can be delivered, meaning that black maternal death, for example, is a situation that cuts across issues of class, that affects all classes of black women. And this has to do with racism in the medical care profession. And that has to be dealt with specifically. And so I think that we have to be sure that when we are talking about universal programs, which are important, that we also recognize the particular ways that black and brown people experience racism, oppression, and inequality in this country, and that has to also be specifically addressed in the here and now. But then beyond that, I think that part of the excitement about the campaign is about thinking beyond what we have been told we have the ability to think beyond. And so in the same way that a discussion, a mainstream discussion has opened up about universal health care, about free college, and now about a potential housing guarantee, housing for everyone, I think that we have to think about, talk about the ways that the resources that are used in this country. We give the federal government appropriates almost $1 trillion to the defense, to the Department of Defense in this country. It's a number so big that it's difficult to get your head around. And we have to talk about what the redistribution of those public resources could look like when we're talking about the problems with social welfare. In healthcare and childcare and all of these things in this country. And so I think that we can't just accept the constraints that are imposed on us in terms of what is possible, that now's an opportunity to think beyond what is possible and start talking about the things that we actually want.
Thank you. Yes. Oh, you have a remark.
Yeah, I want to pick up on something. I think that's a really good point, that there's this argument that's been had, and we've talked about this a little. The critique of the universal is that historically these universal programs have left people behind, and that is an accurate critique. But there are two ways you can go with a response. One response can be to say, okay, the rising tide didn't lift all ships, so screw tides. we're not going to do universal programs at all. Every woman for herself, I guess. And then the other approach, which I would support, is to say, okay, well, if the rising tide didn't raise all those ships because there were holes in the boat, let's plug the holes and design programs that are intersectional, that actually anticipate and look to the historical failings of other programs and do a better job. And so I want to really credit that critique of what universal programs have done in the past that was destructive and widening gaps, because they are not a panacea. But that is that the answer to that is not to say poo-poo universal programs. It's to say that we have to do what this campaign has worked really hard to do, which is to keep all of those different populations in mind and the ways in which the tide is going to affect them differently, and make sure that we don't make those mistakes again.
Which means expanding our horizon of what we think is possible through universal programs, I think, mm-hmm. and how they're enacted. Thank you both so much. I've got to move on from our question and answer session. I want to introduce Jawanza Williams. Jawanza is from the DSA's Afro-Socialists and Socialists of Color Caucus, and he has some remarks that he'd like to share.
Thank you so much, especially Professor Kianga. I have very brief remarks, and I need to read them because I'm nervous. So good evening, and thank you, Jacobin, for holding this prescient event. Again, my name is Jawanza, and I'm a member of the Afro-Socialist and Socialists of Color Caucus of the DSA. And we are a nationwide group of non-white socialists committed to acknowledging that capitalism is always racialized, insisting both inside of the DSA and in wider movements that we cannot usher in socialist futures when we consider class above or without race, when class is actually a product of racism. Afro-socialists, AfroSoc was created for Black, Indigenous, and people of color to have political discourse in an affirming space. We are committed to building political power with and amplifying the experiences and the needs of the poor and working class, because they are at the foundation of our analysis, the most marginal people in our society. We will always demand solidarity with Black, Indigenous, and people of color around the world, and a socialism that considers the realities of race fully. We are here to encourage discussion about the very real issues that people are dealing with in this country, like hunger, poverty, homelessness, violent policing, lack of access to equitable health care, and workers' rights and protections, because we need to get on the same page as a movement. And that means electorally, and that means in our own work as organizers, as socialists in the U.S. And we have to do better when it comes to understanding how race is wrapped up in all of the struggles that we are working on and face that full on. And we need everyone to do their part, and that's to make space and listen to the voices of working and poor people of color if we want to win and not only improve conditions for our people in this country, but literally use the existing ways that we already have that exist, that work best for the people that we're talking about today, the most marginal. And where that doesn't exist, we need to create new structures of engagement. So that means we need an ever-increasing grassroots participation beyond college campuses and the sort, and in the communities of the people I am representing here, and meaningful commitments to seek and adhere to the guidance of people who are actually experiencing the crisis of capitalism the most. Further, we acknowledge that we are living in a world structured by white supremacist ideology, all but ensuring that no candidate acquiring power of this empire will be perfect. However, anyone who is serious about justice and the level of transformative change needed for liberation must put in the work to uplift marginalized communities beyond their stories for political expediency and listen to and follow their demands. So I call on the Black, Brown, Indigenous, and people of color to join the Afro-Socialist and People of Color Caucus and mold this movement and the world towards liberation like your life depends on it, because it does. Thank you so much.
Jawanza Williams from the DSA's Afro-Socialist Caucus and Socialists of Color Caucus. Thank you. So we have some prepared questions from some groups that I received prior to the event, and they're sort of broken down into areas of focus, so I'm going to ask them together. The first is from Housing Organizers for Empowerment, who write, "It can sometimes feel like the conversation around racial justice focuses on criminal justice reform, But as black and brown tenants know, that housing policy in this country has been shaped by systematic racism, and that has led to a housing crisis in cities across America. As a solution, some advocates have conflated affordable housing and workforce housing. That is, combining homelessness, low income, and middle class needs together. How does such an approach sufficiently address the complexities of the debate? Or are cities more successful when they address these issues separately? And how would a Sanders presidency approach these issues? We just had one housing question. Apologies. There it is.
I feel like I've been taking all of the first. If you want to.
Well, no, I think, at least with the first part of that question, I think that the cities have no particular agenda around solving the housing crisis, because in many of these cities, the elected officials are, let's just say, under the influence of the real estate industry. And so it means that the so-called political solutions that they come up with often tend to reflect the priorities of developers, of bankers, and of real estate operatives. And so part of what needs to change around that, I mean, we have a kind of burgeoning housing movement that exists in different cities around the country, because the lack of what is affordable? You know, this thing of affordable housing, the guarantee of safe, sound housing that actually fits into the budget of ordinary people has become something that is quite difficult, if not impossible, to obtain, because there's no correlation between price and need. This is the market, once again, working its dubious magic. And so part of what has to happen, I think, is that there the various movement around these issues of housing, I think I can't remember what the name of the group is that produced the Homes Guarantee, which I think some of which is reflected in Sanders' new housing for all policies. But we have to, again, start to make demands on what it is that we want to see out of a credible housing program, and not just kind of leave that to the whims of city planners to come up with these plans, because time and time again in city after city we see that they have no solution, and in fact things are getting worse. The proportion of people who are paying higher percentages of their income just to put a roof over their head is continuing to grow, and because it's housing, in the same way with pharmaceuticals, with food, it doesn't matter what the price is, you have to pay for it because you have to have it. And this is part of the problem with having a price on these things in the first place. So it's not a solution, but it's a different idea of what it is that we need to do to think about how to advance the demands that we want around housing.
Yeah. So I think the question might have come before the housing policy drop this week. So before. Housing for All is the headline.
Good job anticipating that answer.
It was all planned. But look, here's the stats. There's 500,000 homeless people in America. There are 18 million Americans who cannot, who are paying more than 50% of their income to housing. There is not a single state in this country where a person working 40 hours a week on a minimum wage salary can afford a one-bedroom apartment. And at the same time, you have cities like San Francisco with sky-high rent and incredible amounts of vacancies, right? So the policy does break out discreetly the various interests, the unique concerns of the homeless population, the unique concerns of low-income people, the unique concerns of people who want to be first-time home buyers, across a kind of an economic spectrum. It does things like create a vacancy tax so that people have to pay for keeping these homes empty.
It invests an enormous amount of money into covering the housing deficit and encouraging new homes to be built that are also green homes, because again, all these things are intersectionally devised. And it's a policy that takes seriously the idea of housing as a human right, to Kianga's point, that there are some things that we're willingness to pay, many things, we're willingness to pay does not equal an ability to pay. And if there's certain basic interests like food, shelter, and an ability to keep a roof over your head, then we need to provide those as a society. And one last intersectional point is I was speaking to a doctor for our podcast, the campaign's podcast called Hear the Burn, which I host, which everyone should subscribe to right now on your phone. and we were talking about the maternal mortality rate. And he said, you know what, I have these patients coming into me for their maternity checkups, and every time they come in, they have to fill out a new address. And that kind of housing instability has an enormous effect on what's happening with these women's pregnancies and their survival rates and the survival rates of their children. So this is not a frivolous, this is not, there are those who would say, gosh, Bernice just thinks everything's a human right and is gonna give us all these things for free. I mean, well, when you know that whether someone else has, when someone has stable housing can mean life or death for themselves or their children, I would say, well, hell yes, this is a human right and we're gonna provide it.
And to that end, you have Black women being jailed for essentially being homeless and trying to get their child into a public school out of their district.
Right.
So yeah, it absolutely all interlinks. This dovetails very much with the housing question, but it's more focused on homelessness. It's from a member leader with Vocal NY, a group that organizes around issues of homelessness. They ask, how could we as a movement push Senator Sanders as president to consider the racialized reality of the housing crisis nationally and implement a plan to rehouse over 500,000 homeless people? You did sort of get to that. I'll let either of you take this on.
Can you just repeat the last
part? Sure, sure. How can we push Senator Sanders to consider the racialized reality of the housing crisis nationally and implement a plan to rehouse the over 500,000 homeless?
I think that this is connected to what it is that we are demanding. And so I think of the 500,000 people that are homeless in the US, I think something like 40%. There's a disproportionate number of them are African American and Black families. And so I think in that regard, that is what we should be talking about, is the disproportionate way that African Americans are affected by this. But I think this is part of the demand for thinking about the use of public resources differently. And I would say, and I think that Sanders' housing plan actually reflects that. I mean, I think that it's fairly impressive the way that the plan absorbs some of the key recommendations from grassroots activists, Black activists who are rooted in the housing movement. But I also, again, think that this is an opportunity to think differently about some of these issues. And I think in the same way that we have begun to normalize the discussion about universality, that we need to think about that in terms of housing as well, and to get away from this framework of affordable housing. And I think beyond getting beyond this question of affordability as opposed to guarantee that everyone has the right to live in safe and sound shelter, that part of that is also challenging the way that homeownership has been so sacrosanct in this society, and that your ability to own a home and your ability to own an asset that accrues value over time then determines your access to upward mobility or social mobility in this society. That this is a problem. Your ability to send your kid to school or to weather a healthcare crisis or to retire with dignity should not depend on your ability to own property. in the United States. And it does. And so I think that this, these are all opportunities now that we have to think about things differently, to think about how our society, what is prioritized and how it is arranged in a different way. And housing is the perfect opportunity to do that, because one of the reasons why it's so difficult to organize over a sustained period of time is because it gets to the heart of the inequality of within capitalism, because of the way that private property is so central to this. It makes it very difficult to challenge. So you have this kind of constant ebb and flow in movements that develop around housing, because if we wanted to be honest, we would say there's not a housing crisis. A crisis indicates that there's some kind of breach in what normally happens. Well, the reality is that there has not been safe, sound, and affordable housing for poor and working class people in this country ever, for the entirety of the 20th century and now into the 21st century. And so this is, again, means that we have to think differently about this problem and begin to come up with systemic solutions to it, instead of adapting our solutions to the current configuration, which is reproduce the crisis over and over again.
Just to the racialized point, I should point out that there is an entire section of our housing policy specifically about redlining and redressing the inequities that we are continuing to live with today, including redlining ongoing today. So there is a tribunal of sorts which is intended to create accountability and provide redress for those who both have been historically discriminated against and people who were not bailed out after the housing crisis when Wall Street was. And that's a really big and really important and valuable part of this plan.
Thank you. Our next question are sort of more specific to the issues facing African Americans. So I'll read three of them. Gotta make sure they're all in order. And then I'll let you respond. So question one is from Black Lives Matter Greater New York. Hi. The question is, beyond the wealth tax and student debt forgiveness, will we see a plan to address poverty and inequality in the Black community specifically? Question two is from the New York DSA Radical Justice Working Group. No one's revving them out in the audience tonight, I guess. Their question is, we know Bernie advocates for a Medicare for All plan that will benefit large or underinsured populations of people of color. This system will require a lot of transition time and might even end up overloading low-income clinics and hospitals in areas where folks who might not have insurance or have poor insurance coverage will now be insured. How will Bernie's plan account for the already broad discrepancies in healthcare when doctors in these areas might quickly become overworked? Does any part of his Medicare for All policy address disparities in quality of care between even a few blocks in New York City? Does any part of this policy address the maternal mortality rate for Black women? Are there any educational components to his plan that will address these disparities, including that many medical professionals still believe Black bodies to be biologically different, more pain tolerant, thicker skin, etc., than white bodies? And the third question is from Afro-Socialists and Socialists of Color Caucus. There they are. Bernie's campaign excites so many people because of his promise to address economic inequality in America. A large part of this inequality stems from our country's legacy of slavery and colonialism. With this fact in mind, DSA's Afro-Socialists and Socialists of Color Caucus has invested time and energy into contemplating reparations as a policy and how that policy could be enacted in our time. Sanders initially opposed reparations for slavery as divisive, and has since been pressured to support Congressman Conyers' H.R. 40 bill, which will study reparations. Bernie has said, quote, "If a reparations bill comes across my desk, I will sign it." This comment suggests that he won't actively join in the fight for reparations or actively oppose it either. Given these mixed messages, we wonder how a Sanders presidency would address the issue of reparations, if at all. What does a socialist reparations program look like for you? And what accountability mechanisms can be set up within a socialist Sanders administration to ensure the demands of working class communities of color, like reparations, are listened to and fought for? I know that's a lot. I will pass them down. And I suppose let's start with, which one was first? It was the wealth tax student debt forgiveness question, and will we see a plan to address poverty and inequality in the Black community specifically? Should we start there?
Sure. What's interesting about that question to me is the wealth tax and the student debt forgiveness don't specifically address Black poverty, right? So the examples given seem to anticipate or contemplate that there are policies that are absolutely disproportionately affecting the Black community. Black women hold more student debt than any other group. Not that I have any personal knowledge of that. you know, the wealth tax obviously is not just a tax on white people, but it's disproportionately going to be given the way the wealth is concentrated in this country. So the question of what to do, what plans are specifically going to address Black people that don't address everybody else, is a difficult one, because so often the Black community is a canary in the coal mine. And the things, if you're helping the Black community, it ends up helping other communities as a result. If that is in fact just a question about reparations, you want to skip down to the reparations question, then Bernie Sanders, like everybody else in this race, you know, supports H.R. 40. I don't know that I agree with the characterization of how he came to supporting H.R. 40, but you know, there was a reparations hearing a couple of months ago in Washington, D.C., and one of our surrogates, Danny Glover, was the main speaker on behalf of the bill. And so there have been efforts in the past that Senator Sanders has supported, reparations efforts such as the 2010 bill to restore reparations, to give reparations to Black farmers who had been hurt by, who had been basically systemically robbed by the government. We also have plans to do things like, for example, not just legalize marijuana and expunge records, but to say that the proceeds going forward from these marijuana sales have to be disproportionately given to the communities that have been disproportionately harmed from them. You can't have people sitting in jail, you know, and you have been sitting in jail for the exact same thing that a bunch of disproportionately white people are about to make a lot of money off of. I mean, that's the way it works. I have classmates who are currently ramping up to be in the, classmates from Harvard Law School who are ramping up to be in the marijuana industry, and I feel some kind of way about it.
Gotta end that student debt somehow.
I mean,
if it's not Bernie's plan.
Well, fair enough. But this question, and we've talked about this a little bit, and so I don't, you know, I'm curious to know what you think. This question of, I understand this kind of, like the impulse to want something given how many things have specifically hurt Black people in this country, specifically because you're Black, to have plans that specifically help us because we're Black. And there are aspects of so many of these plans that address the fact that there are specific racial harms, like the redlining plan. And I think the goal of H.R. 40 is to say, how can we go about finding what all of those avenues are, what all of the possibilities are to find those redress and accommodate them, right? You know, we're a campaign that focuses more than any other on the excesses of corporate power, the ways that corporations specifically have benefited from slavery. You know, the 1619 Project has surfaced all kinds of interesting factoids, like the fact that at a certain point in American history, if you total the value of all of the corporations and all of the railroads in the country, they didn't equal the value of slave labor, right? And that the value of that slave labor was being sold and traded all over the world, so that it wasn't even isolated to an American phenomenon.
phenomenon. You know, the entire globe is benefiting off of slave labor. Aetna, the insurance company, recently had to apologize for insuring enslaved people, to insure slave owners for the value of enslaved people. So if they die, the slave owner gets paid out, right? And these companies persist and, you know, oppress us.
They should apologize.
Ways.
They should pay.
They should pay. Right.
So I'm a socialist for reparations. I think reparations are important for a number of reasons. One is that we can identify many of the organizations and institutions that were connected to the slave trade, the ways in which they profited from the slave trade. We can begin with the U.S. government. And so often the critics of reparations, you know, oh, how will we know? How will we figure any of this out? Many times in black families, people actually know what generation, who was enslaved, where, so on and so forth. So it's not as mysterious as it's made out to be. But I think that politically, there's an important reason to support a struggle around reparations and the payment of reparations itself. And we should say that a healthy majority, around 60% of African Americans, not only want reparations as, you know, an acknowledgement that racism exists or that slavery existed and slavery was a thing, but black people want money. Black people want to be paid. They want cash for reparations. And so I think that is an important, it's an important thing to say that this is not some weird political hangover from the 1960s that people drag up generationally, you know, at weird periodic times, but that this is something that African Americans actually believe in. The second thing is that a fight around reparations, to me, is about educating white people in this country about racism, slavery, and its relationship historically to the conditions that we find in this country today. And it's not just about slavery, although I think that's a good place to start because there is such profound ignorance in this country about the institution of slavery. But it's also about the ways that the slavery bequeaths to generations thereafter racism, which is then perpetuated in such ways as to impact the lives of African Americans in particular well into the 21st century. So we talk about the history of redlining, we could talk about job discrimination, we could talk about all the manifestations of this that have led to twice as many black people being unemployed since the 1950s as white people, no matter the condition of the economy. The concentration of disproportionate levels of poverty, so on and so forth, all connected to racism, all connected to the institution of slavery. And so it's just as important in terms of the education of the public. And so, and not to beat people over the head or educate yourself so you can have more interesting dinner time conversations, but to really understand also the connection between racism and what happens to the lives of ordinary white people in this country. Because poverty, for example, has been so racialized in this country, we ignore the fact that there are huge swaths of poverty among ordinary white people. There are 20 million poor white people in this country. The life expectancy of white people in the United States has gone into reverse for men and women. This does not happen in the developed world. And it is driven by alcoholism, opioid addiction, and suicide. And we can't even talk about it because poverty is a black thing. And so the ignorance around racism, slavery, and its history, and how it affects the lives of ordinary white people is a problem politically. And so the fight around reparations is about understanding this history. It's about connecting it to the contemporary situation that we're in. And so I think that, you know, for me, that is why it's an important struggle. I wrote about this in Jacobin. I think it's called The Consequences of Forgetting.
Check it out, jacobin.com. I'd like to just return to the question of the Medicare for All plan and the ways in which it will address potential overloading of low-income clinics and hospitals. I'd add that also there are a great deal of people in rural communities who have to drive over an hour or 2 hours to get to any kind of viable medical care. So how does Sanders' Medicare for All plan address that and the racial disparities of care therein?
Yeah, so when Medicare was put into effect, there was this concern that suddenly the nation's hospitals were going to be inundated with our elderly, and there weren't going to be enough beds left. And that did not happen. And part of why that didn't happen is because our hospitals, our for-profit hospitals, operate in such a way that they basically make sure there's no vacancies at the end. So they'll keep you a little extra for an extra test, et cetera, tests that they are able to bill for, and keep all the beds occupied. If they have more people coming in, they'll usher you out faster, right? So there's kind of like a faux scarcity model. At the same time, under our for-profit system, we have hospitals closing at an alarming rate already. The campaign, again, used its text listserv to direct people to go and help protest at Hahnemann Hospital in Pennsylvania about a month ago, which is closing because a venture capitalist is buying bought the property and is now basically shutting it down and flipping it into condos. Right. So what Bernie Sanders has done in partnership with Representative Conyers is to put together he found $11 billion, for these community health centers, which disproportionately focus on rural and urban communities that are disproportionately underserviced by hospitals and make sure that they are able to stay afloat. Additionally, following the Hahnemann Hospital debacle, he has pledged another $20 billion as a fund to help struggling hospitals like that to be able to fight back, and for the government basically to be able to buy them back so that venture capitalists aren't able to do that anymore. There was another part of this, which was the disparities point. So part of our Medicare for All plan is to, back to the intersectional nature of this, is to make sure that we have more Black doctors and nurses by, one, making public colleges and universities tuition free, and fully funding HBCUs, which graduate a disproportionate number of Black doctors in this country. There is also there are accountability aspects of the bill, and since it's bias training and things like that. But back to the point that we opened with, you know, bias in hospitals isn't only practiced by white doctors, right? When you look at these kind of tests, the implicit bias tests, which have come under some controversy but and what have you, but bias, when you look at who's committing these police shootings, oftentimes there are Black and brown and Asian people behind the guns, right? So this is a broader systemic cultural societal question of how do we get to a point where Black doctors too aren't considering Black patients to have less sensitivity to pain, where we don't have basically an opioid epidemic that is disproportionately hurting white communities, because white communities are getting more opioids to manage their pain because they're perceived as having more pain than Black people who are just being left to suffer. But a weird positive consequence of that is that we don't have as much of that crisis, right? So, like, that is one of these problems that we should recognize that exists, but isn't necessarily going to be solved by a swoop of a pen in this way.
I agree.
Thank you both so much for addressing those questions. Just gonna check our time. So we've got a little time for some audience questions. We don't have a ton. I'm very sorry, audience. All of your questions were great, at least those that I received. I'm gonna start with this one. Sorry, no shade, guys. how can grassroots movements allied with the Sanders campaign respond to the center's incorrect assessment that the most toxic Bernie supporters are representative of all of us?
I'll just say really quickly, I don't know what you can do about that. It's like there is a concerted effort by the mass media and the leadership of the Democratic Party to try to bury this campaign, and so they enjoy this, you know? And I think one thing is to not take the bait and to really, you know, think about the wider opportunities. I mean, everyone, and I understand the disappointment with the Working Families Party endorsement, but who was talking about the fact that the U.S., Postal Workers Union endorsed Bernie Sanders? The Postal Workers Union is 200,000. It's 200,000 workers, 40% women, 20% black. This is incredibly significant and important, and nobody's talking about it because we're talking about what didn't happen. And so this was kind of like what I was trying to say in my opening comments, is that we don't have to respond to things from bitterness and despair and they're wronging us and this is horrible. And, you know, those things happen because this is an insurgent campaign that the political establishment wants to smother in the cradle because of everything that the campaign represents, that Sanders represents an existential threat to the Democratic Party, to the political leadership of the Democratic Party. And so they're, of course, it's dirty trick season, it's nasty comment season, it's crazy season. But we have the donors, 1 million donors, right? Disproportionately at Walmart, working class people. It's the postal workers. The postal workers have a tremendous and heroic legacy and history of militancy and fighting. And these are things that we have to point to and understand the larger dynamics within which the campaign is operating that allows for this stuff. I mean, Time Magazine is running an article on nasty tweets people who say they're from the Sanders campaign sent. Right? Why are they doing that? You know why they're doing that. So.
Because we got to 1 million donations,
right,
today,
exactly.
Individual donors, exactly. Today. I mean, that's American history that just was made today. I don't think that that's an accident, right? It was a crazy day on Twitter. I'm a little tired as a result of all of that. But I do think it's hard. I do want to validate because, look, I became a journalist. I started writing largely because I was so frustrated in 2017 by all of the Bernie bro stuff that just wouldn't go away. So I want to validate what it feels like to be a supporter, yes, of someone and be told constantly that you either don't exist, that despite the fact that we have the least white, most female, most working class campaign of the field of 85, that we're still somehow bros and tyrants, despite the fact that the black women in particular that are associated with this campaign receive an outsized amount of the exact kind of hate that they claim to disclaim. And there is broad silence about that among the same people who have, you know, fixed their Twitter fingers to have a lot of opinions today. You know, it's a kind of hypocrisy that can be really demoralizing. So I would, you know, encourage you to Kianga's point, to emphasize and respond with the positive stories that they don't want us to be covering. Now, they can still ignore it. You know, we had the hashtag, the Bernie Stories hashtag, which was trending, I think globally even, but definitely nationally, right? Where thousands of people shared their most personal, intimate stories about why they were involved in this campaign. It was ignored by the mainstream media, except for one hateful tweet by one person who has a legacy of actually the exact kind of bigoted attacks that are now being called out. And that was what was elevated up to the mainstream news. So they can ignore us, but what I find to be reassuring is that only at tops, like 3 million people watch the mainstream media shows, that there is an incredible amount of outreach that is happening on non-traditional media. Again, listen to my podcast. But also, you know, we sat down with Cardi B and that got over, you know, 20 million hits. And, you know, it's not a celebrity fluff interview. It's an interview where a working class young woman from the Bronx asks questions that are relevant to her and her community. Same with these interviews with Killer Mike. He went on the Joe Rogan show and within 48 hours got 8 million hits on that podcast, right? So there are ways that we can get around it, and I would just, you know, say don't get demoralized because the vast, vast, vast majority of people aren't on Twitter and also, frankly, aren't watching the mainstream news.
one more question. I guess it's sort of in the, oh no, I'm gonna go with this one, sorry guys. Okay. How will we deal with the Department of Justice taking 5 years on Eric Garner's case and so many other cases where people of color are murdered at the hands of the police, not receiving any kind of due process or justice within the DOJ or other state and city municipal justice systems, and how will Sanders address this utter silence in the criminal justice community when a person of color is killed by a police officer?
So for one thing, I think it's a lot of people don't understand the role that our kind of local electeds play in these decisions, right? People we aren't paying attention to, who our district attorneys are, who the people are, these prosecutors who actually are the ones, much more so than police officers, who are making these determinations about how justice gets served and who, in fact, is served. The point Roland Martin made on this panel was that he was talking to a group of young youths in his neighborhood about some of the tragic incidents of police shootings, and he asked them, "Well, did you would you prefer if X, Y, and Z person do you want to see them go to jail? The cop who did it." And he said, "Yes." He said, "Well, have you registered to vote?" And they said no, and they said, "Oh, well, then you'll never have an opportunity to sit on a jury and actually be in a position to decide, right?" And so I do think that there's a lot there about local awareness and the role that district attorneys in particular are playing in this process, and we should continue. There's been more of that lately. I think the rise of the prominence of Larry Krasner in Philadelphia has made it increasingly clear that there is a such thing as a progressive prosecutor. There are many people who are adopting that label who are not progressive prosecutors, and it's important for us to keep that straight and to be really clear about folks' records. But people need to understand how much power prosecutors really honestly have. Prosecutorial discretion is perhaps the most powerful tool to change our criminal justice system immediately, especially since so much of it is a local practice. So my main piece of advice there would be for us to start mobilizing around those kinds of elections.
I would just say quickly, we also need to rebuild a grassroots, we need to rebuild a grassroots movement against police abuse and violence. And, because I live in Philly, and so Krasner is there. Krasner does many good things. I like Larry Krasner. And at the same time, Pennsylvania is like a plantation, and you have Pittsburgh and you have Philadelphia, and then you have this entire state of racist rednecks who basically go to the state house and make, and try to undermine what is happening in those cities. And so there's been a backlash of these state representatives in Pennsylvania who are trying to attack Krasner's political, Krasner's approach to criminal justice in the city of Philadelphia that has absolutely nothing, has nothing to do with them. And so that is the whole point about, you can't just rely on getting good people into office, because there are larger forces that are also in office that will try to undermine that. And so the one thing that we have to try to challenge that is our ability to organize ourselves independently, so that when the regressive forces try to take things backwards to where they were before, that we are able to create some resistance and challenge to that as well.
Thank you.
Hello, how is everybody? We experienced a little bit of a empty space, but this is because it was necessary to change you to the new vibration. Do you feel that change? It was a vibration because before it was all serious stuff, you know, serious conversation. And now it's 8 o'clock. It's actually 8 o'clock, and the clock keeps ticking on the seconds, 37, 38, 39. There's a lot of activity here at KBOO 90.7 FM. And at almost 8:01, I tell you, welcome to Squirrel Snow with me, Ender Black. How are you? My pleasure to be here again once a month, playing some of my songs that would hopefully make you feel better, or at least make that drive better, or whatever you're doing. I suggest, if you haven't done it already, you download the KBOO app. If you have iPhones or Androids, you can go to the stores and to the phone stores and download the free app, which is actually a very good app that works really well, and it doesn't occupy any